What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back, having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, inside the cell is a tiny double helix, another fancy word for DNA. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be recording the first part of a two-part episode on one of the most interesting molecules in the entire universe. Dare I say the single most interesting molecule?
I mean, it depends on if you like your nucleic acids being ribose-oriented or deoxyribose-oriented.
Get that ribose out of my face. This is DNA. It's DNA time. So this is going to be part one. And today we're going to mostly be focusing on the history and the current research around using DNA. But please stick with us also for next time, when we're going to focus on some topics around using DNA as a technological tool.
Yeah. And as we record this, it is April 25th, which is National DNA Day.
Complete coincidence, but a lovely coincidence.
Yeah. It's,
we had no idea.
Yeah, we didn't. I just happened to find it while I was doing a search on news about DNA. And the reason it is National DNA Day is that on this day in 2003, the Human Genome Project completed its quest to map out the human genome. So there you go. Happy National DNA Day.
Yay.
So where's the treasure buried?
Sadly, we don't have all the information necessary to find the treasure. Here's the thing.
The last part is stored in an R2 unit that we can't get to wake up.
Yeah, it was... I'm not going to go down the Force Unleashed path of logic. Therein lies madness. But I do want to say that I read an interesting thing from one of the researchers who worked on the genome project. And because they're often asked, well, if you mapped out the genome, why haven't we cured cancer yet?
Right.
Right. And they said, well, think of it this way. imagine that the human genome is really a collection of ancient books written in a language no one speaks or writes in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have just spent more, you know, a decade or more collecting all of the books, and now you are absolutely certain that you have all the books that make up the entire collection of this one library, but you still can't read them yet.
Or not all of them.
Or at least not all of them. And that's what is going to be taking up a lot of time for the next decade or so,
yeah.
while we learn what these books say and what they mean and how to use them.
Yeah, right now we've got the equivalent of like Run Spot Run.
Yeah.
Or Go Spot Go. I'm behind on my board book titles.
That's See Dick and Jane is what you're talking about.
Sure.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But yeah, so today in this first episode, we wanted to just talk about what DNA is and what it is being used for currently. Go into a little bit of the history of how it was potentially created here on the planet Earth and also how we discovered it, because, you know, it's a relatively recent discovery in human history.
Yeah. Right. So let's start with the basics. At base, DNA is, of course, chemistry, but as we all know, it's the basis for all of the stuff we know of in the universe that is definitely in the alive category, though maybe not some things that are just maybe sort of alive, like prions. And we're not going to do all the standard stuff you learned in school about what DNA does, but just for a brief refresher, the really simple version, what does DNA do? Well, you can think about your body as a type of machine, and mm-hmm. that machine is made up of parts, and most of these parts are proteins. Proteins are like tiny, very simple robots that work together to make more complex robots that are your organs, which of course work together to make the real robot, which is you.
Right.
Meat robots, yay.
But there are all these little robots in your body, and they're proteins. So what makes these proteins? The answer is DNA. DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, is a long chain molecule. It's one really huge long molecule that contains an ordered sequence of what are called nucleotides. These are the building blocks of the DNA. And the sequence of the nucleotides, what order they come in, determines what proteins get made and how they get used. So DNA, you can think of it as like both the code for what your body should be like and also the machine that builds the machines that builds the machines that build your body.
Right.
One protein at a time.
Now, if you find all that confusing, you can just refer to the helpful educational film Mr. DNA at the beginning of Jurassic Park.
Which is so good.
It is. I actually watched it.
Mr. DNA, where did you come from?
I watched it again before we recorded this show. So let's talk about, like, well, where do we think DNA came from? Like, we know that it's integral to life here on Earth. How did it get started?
That's a really interesting question, and it's easily a whole episode in itself, so we can't explore that entirely here if we want to get to all the other stuff we were going to talk about today. But the short answer is this is still a really big unsettled question in the origins of life and biochemistry. We have some good ideas, but nobody really knows with confidence yet where DNA came from and exactly what role it played in the emergence of life on Earth. For example, one big question. Like we said earlier, DNA is the basis of pretty much all life on Earth today, but which came first, DNA or life?
Mm-hmm.
Was there non-DNA-based life before there was DNA-based life?
Yeah, it's one of those chicken or the egg kind of questions.
Exactly. It really is. And there have been plenty of people looking into trying to at least hypothesize where DNA came from, whether or not it was a product of some early form of life, or if in fact it was the thing that allowed life to emerge.
Yeah, and one issue here is that DNA is a very complex molecule. It doesn't, and so for this reason, people generally don't think it looks like something that would randomly self-assemble without some sort of precursor. And so a lot of the investigations on where did DNA come from are looking at like, well, what could a chemical precursor be? What could there have been that facilitated the creation of this really complex molecule? And one very popular theory, though we don't know it's the answer yet, it's a strong hypothesis, is the so-called RNA world.
Right. So ribonucleic acid.
Yeah.
This is a somewhat simpler molecule than DNA.
Let's clarify the difference there between the two.
All right, so they're both nucleic acids. First of all, the sugar element of the nucleic acids, they're composed of a sugar element as well as some other pieces. But the sugar element is different for both. You have a deoxyribose for DNA and mm-hmm. just ribose for RNA.
Yeah.
So that's a major difference right there.
Who gets out of bed for ribose? Really, you got to hold out for that deoxyribose.
Well, yeah. If you're lacking DNA, you're not getting out of bed. DNA is double stranded. You know, we think of that classic double helix.
Yeah, the twisted ladder.
Right.
We'll talk about in a minute.
RNA is a single strand molecule. DNA stores and transfers genetic information in humans. RNA codes for amino acids and acts kind of like a messenger between DNA and ribosomes to make proteins.
Right.
So those are the differences. So. Let's talk about some of the research. In 2009, a group of scientists successfully synthesized two of the four nucleotides that make up RNA using chemicals that we believe were present on primordial Earth. So this does not necessarily mean that the hypothesis is true. It just means it makes it sort of plausible, at least for RNA, right? That RNA could spontaneously form based upon some conditions on Earth. And again, it's only the proof of two of those four nucleotides. They're still working on the other two to see if there's a way that the chemicals that we think were around in primordial Earth could have developed into these building blocks for RNA.
Right.
Now, one of those scientists has since gone on to see if he can do the same thing with DNA nucleotides using a similar approach to that RNA experiment. But sugars in DNA nucleotides are harder to work with than RNA counterparts. Before you actually assemble into DNA. Once it's assembled in DNA, it's really stable.
Yeah.
But before then, it's just tough to work with. So ultimately, we still don't know if RNA and also DNA preceded life. But at least the work that we've seen so far suggests that it's still plausible. It's not necessarily a dead end yet until we get to a point that we have to say, well, we've tried everything. We can't get any of these chemicals to work out the way we thought it would back on the primordial Earth conditions. Maybe there's an alternative answer to this question.
Yeah. But it's a fascinating question.
Absolutely.
It's crazy that we don't know the answer to this. And
oh, yeah.
So it's so exciting to read about what we're learning.
Yeah. It's so big and basic. Other research that I read indicated that that another factor, meteor impacts in primordial Earth, might have been the key to putting all of this together. Mm-hmm. One of the theories about how DNA and life in general arose on Earth is that amino acids and nucleotides hitched a ride here on meteors and other bodies that, were from elsewhere.
Right.
And that's how they got here.
Now, of course, that doesn't answer the question of how they were assembled, but that's how they arrived on this planet.
Sure, which is, it's a set of questions that all go together.
I mean, right. Clearly the lizard people put it together.
Yeah.
Right.
And they put it on rocks and pushed them to Earth.
Well, absolutely.
Is that what you call those naked dudes in Prometheus?
Lizard people? No, I call them frequently. Go ahead, Lauren.
Excellent. So there has been, though, skepticism in the research community about whether the breadth of amino acids and nucleotides that we see here on Earth could have possibly arrived intact or even could have formed from things that might have arrived intact.
Mm.
But so there was this study that was published back in August of 2015 by a team out of Japan, and they simulated a meteorite hitting an ancient ocean. And they found that the energy from the impact, together with the raw physical materials, the inorganic compounds that were likely to have been present, could indeed have formed nucleotides and amino acids. They found when they studied their post-impact stuff, they found 9 amino acids that are all involved with the formation of proteins and also 2 nucleotides. So that's pretty fascinating. That's great.
That's really an interesting idea. And obviously, if we were to study this further and conclude that, in fact, these molecules were extraterrestrial in nature, as Joe was pointing out, that then leads to a whole new series of questions about
which are maybe even more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may be that perhaps these are questions that are ultimately unknowable to us. We don't, maybe that we will have a certain percentage of certainty for one versus another, but, I'm not entirely certain, short of time travel, how we would ever get to the very bottom of this. Like, what would be the conclusive proof that would make one hypothesis stand well over the other?
Yeah, it seems like probably the best we could hope to do is if we could offer a lot of hypotheses and note that eventually one of them works under lab conditions and the others don't, which
right.
gives you some degree of confidence that that's probably the right answer, but we'll never really know.
Right. It's not really a provable hypothesis. But hey, okay, so speaking of time travel, we have here in the studio with us today the Wayback Machine, borrowed from Tech Stuff.
Yeah, Tech Stuff and Stuff You Should Know. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen this baby, and I gotta tell you, it's a little worse for wear. I'm pretty sure the Stuff You Should Know guys have been going back to the 60s for some fun, but
Josh and Chuck.
Let's put it to use and really find out, like, let's talk about the actual discovery of DNA, not when it was potentially first formed on Earth, but when we humans first became aware of it.
Okay, well, you may have heard this story before. Of course, the answer is that Watson and Crick discovered DNA in the 1950s, except that's not true.
What?
Wait,
but the book told me.
No, this is the thing.
Books never lie, Joe.
For some reason, I've read about this before, and even my brain goes to this place. Yeah, Watson and Crick, 1950s, discovered DNA. That's not true.
No.
So who really did discover DNA, and what is it that Watson and Crick supposedly discovered or contributed to our understanding of DNA? One interesting fact to point out, people knew about heredity before they knew about DNA, and this is a thing that can easily be lost because we now equate DNA in standard conversation with the idea of heritable information.
Mm-hmm.
So you get stuff from your parents, people just say, oh, it's in your DNA.
Right.
But that is a relatively recent thing to enter the common parlance, and so people knew about inheriting traits from parents long before they knew what the molecule was in the body that conveyed that information.
Right.
Right. So in order to get to the bottom of this question, we're going to go back in our way back machine to 1869.
Oh, that's why the numbers are. I was wondering. I just thought that was just randomly put there. When I was saying 60s, I actually did mean the 1860s.
Oh, well, were there good party times there, too?
I just assumed if Josh and Chuck were doing it, but now I know that 1869 was set for us.
1860. Yeah. Have you ever seen Gone with the Wind? There's lots of parties.
Yeah. Right. Let's just
they don't look like a lot of fun.
Let's just get in the Wayback Machine and go check out where we're going.
Okay, we're here, and there's so much pus.
So in 1869, there's this Swiss biochemist at the University of Tübingen, and his name is Johann Friedrich Miescher, and he was studying pus.
That explains this, then.
Yeah, no joke. Yeah, so there was pus everywhere. Miescher had an arrangement, you might say, with a nearby surgical clinic that would send him filthy used bandages that were dripping with pus. And, you know, when you think about filthy used bandages dripping with pus, most people you wouldn't want to handle them, you know, do things with them, spend your Saturday on them.
Not way up on my list of things to do.
But in fact, these pus-soaked bandages turned out to be a scientific gold mine. Because of the following reason. So pus contains mostly dead leukocytes,
right.
which are white blood cells.
Yep.
He was studying these white blood cells to understand the proteins in them. But Miescher also discovered in the course of his research that in the nucleus of each of the white blood cells, there was a common substance that had nitrogen and phosphorus atoms in it. And which was chemically distinct from the protein. So it's this stuff there in the cell nucleus. It's not a protein. It's got nitrogen and phosphorus. What is it? And he called this stuff nuclein, which later became known as nucleic acid. And once it was totally isolated from the surrounding proteins and all the other stuff, the pure molecule got the name we know today, deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA.
Well, this is fascinating, Joe, but I would like us all to take a pledge that none of us will utter the word pus again in the rest of this episode.
I will with one small exception, and that is, can we get out of this pus party? I would like, do you have any parties to take us to that aren't made of pus?
Well, let's see. We could go on the quickly summarized scientific research bandwagon party.
Oh, well, luckily there's a montage button inside the Wayback Machine, so just hit that.
Yeah, now we got to go on the montage because there are actually a bunch of scientists over the ensuing decades that contributed a lot more to the study of heredity and DNA, and we don't have time to go into all of their research. But so after Miescher at this point, you know that there are genes that convey traits from parents to offspring, and we know about DNA, but we hadn't put them together. We didn't know that one was the DNA was the agent of heredity. And so in 1944, a group of scientists, Avery, McLeod, and McCarty, showed that DNA conveys hereditary traits, that DNA is the agent of Mendelian genetics. And finally, in 1953, you finally got to Crick and Watson, plus a couple others, actually. Francis Crick, James Watson, Maurice Wilkins, and Rosalind Franklin demonstrated the structure of DNA. So they put together the model of the double helix molecule of DNA, the one we've all seen now. It looks like a ladder that you twisted up like a spring.
Right. Like a Twizzler.
Yeah. Or like a spiral staircase.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, a spiral ladder, I guess. Yeah. And so it's got two spiraling parallel poles that are connected by rungs of nucleobases. And the important thing about discovering the double helix shape of the molecule was that this showed how the DNA molecule was capable of conveying genetic information.
Mm. Well, let's go ahead and pop on back over into modern day and back into our studio and just concentrate more about other stuff we've learned about this amazing molecule.
Okay, yes, this is better for reasons that I've promised not to mention again. Okay, but
what about pus?
No, Joe. You are so lucky the axe of mysticism is not currently in the podcast studio.
Not the mystical axe. You never use the mystical axe as a weapon.
I'm sorely tempted.
Okay, so despite this rich history of research into DNA, there is still so much that is going on in the field. All these studies being conducted, questions being answered, new questions that we never even conceived of being posed. Mm-hmm. And so... So we wanted to give y'all a quick sample of some of the stuff we've seen recently, just to give you an idea of what kind of things are going on.
Yeah, so first of all, we were talking about that double helix shape. One of the interesting bits of research that we encountered while looking into the topic was that some scientists have shown that DNA doesn't just hold that double helix shape.
Yeah, it actually comes in lots of fun shapes.
Yeah, so as I said, it kind of boogies. It moves around a lot. And actually, when you think about...
Do you get stars, moons, and balloons, and clovers?
It's not the Lucky Charm shapes, although some of them are similar to them. All right, so what's the deal here? We've been told about this double helix shape forever. Why are we suddenly seeing different shapes? Well, part of what I've read is that when Watson and Crick were really describing the structure of DNA, they were looking at a length of DNA that was about 12 base pairs long, something like that, like one turn of DNA. But DNA has to turn many, many, many times. It has to be supercoiled because DNA is a very long molecule. But it has to fit within the nucleus of a cell.
Right. And most nuclei of cells are not a few meters long, which
right.
is really the length of a DNA chain.
Right. So to fit that inside a cell's nucleus, you have to coil and coil and coil and coil this shape. And if you've ever dealt with any kind of like cable or anything, any real long length of something that's got lots of kinks and then, you can see all sorts of weird shapes, and also as you uncoil it, it can spring in ways that are terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So the DNA molecule ends up creating these other odd shapes that the scientists were able to observe. It was kind of interesting how they did it. They used a method called cryo-electron tomography to study the actual shapes, and they observed all sorts of interesting ones, like figure eights or coiled so tightly that it looked like it was a rod, not even two separate strands anymore. Hmm. Also, according to one of the scientists, some of them look like rackets or handcuffs. So maybe if your molecules are being naughty in your cell's nucleus, the DNA will just go ahead and slap the cuffs on. I don't know how that works. At any rate.
No clovers, though?
No clovers that I saw. I mean, it's entirely possible that it just was not included on the list.
Yeah.
Probably horseshoes, though.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you crossed a couple of pairs of handcuffs, you'd essentially have a clover.
Yeah. I would allow for the possibility that a clover could, in fact, be one of the many shapes that DNA could take, but depending on the coiling. Mm-hmm. The important thing here, though, is that understanding the shape of the molecules can help doctors develop better medicines, and scientists help develop better medicines, because the drugs we take, typically what it does is it releases some molecules into our system, and those molecules are looking for other molecules of a specific shape. So knowing more about the shape of DNA can make more effective medicines that are specifically looking for those shapes. So it does have a practical application. It's not just the idea of we just want to learn more. Although, as we say on the show all the time, that in itself is a worthy endeavor most of the time.
Okay, how about one other really interesting fact about DNA? We mentioned earlier how there was the discovery over time that DNA is the gene, that mm-hmm. DNA is the molecule in the body that conveys genetic information from parent to offspring. But one of the weird facts that we're discovering, we actually started discovering in the 20th century, but that we're learning more about all the time, is something called horizontal gene transfer, which is where you can get a gene in your genome that doesn't come from your parents.
What?
Doesn't happen very often with humans. It happens all the time with single-celled organisms like bacteria,
yeah.
where they can trade genes. It's almost like a way for bacteria to sort of have sex. They don't really, but they can exchange genetic information back and forth between their genomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there appears to be DNA within the genomes of larger organisms that looks like it probably came from organisms other than this organism's direct ancestors.
Yeah, yeah. And you might wonder, how could something like that happen? And in fact, it can happen through something that's called the endogenous retrovirus, or ERVs. These are retroviruses that once infected some sort of organism in the past, and they're really, really, really good at replicating themselves, at least for a few generations until mutations make that a non-factor. So the way this works is a retrovirus can replicate itself by infiltrating a cell, a host cell, and it inserts some of its own viral genome into the nuclear genome of the host cell. So it's sort of, you know, hacking into the mainframe, putting a copy of itself into the host cell. Now, this can include, it doesn't normally include, it usually, but it can include germline cells. Those are the cells that produce egg and sperm cells. And once in a while, even more rarely, an infected germline cell will go on to develop into a viable organism. And so then you'll have this viral genome become part of the genome of the overall organism.
Right.
And that's where you get this mysterious DNA that would not have been part of a typical individual of that organism species. It's actually been introduced through this virus.
Yeah.
And these strains of the genome, the viral genome, can remain in the organism's genome over the course of numerous generations, over millions of years, in fact. But because organisms undergo mutation, typically one mutation or another is going to render the viral genome's ability to replicate the actual virus null and void.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll eventually get to a point where the organisms have the viral genome as part of their DNA,
mm-hmm.
but they're not making the virus anymore because of other unrelated mutations that organism species has undergone over multiple generations.
Yeah, and no one's really sure how much of our DNA could have possibly been influenced by this kind of process. Some estimates have it as high as like 8%, which is crazy.
Yeah, now that is amazing, but one thing to clarify is that you shouldn't misunderstand. You shouldn't think that, oh, if I have 8% of my genome from bacteria or viruses or some other organisms on Earth, it's not like that happened since you were born. That means over the generations, this many horizontal gene transfer events have accumulated into the genome that created you when you were born.
Right,
right, right. But part of the reason that it's difficult to suss out how this happens is that it's really hard to get direct observational evidence of it. And one bit of research that we ran across was this study into a transfer between pine trees and insects that happened millions of years ago and basically has made pine trees what they are today.
Yeah.
It's the first time that it's one of the few times, rather, that we have directly observed, been able to directly trace that kind of data. So,
yeah,
cool stuff.
It's really interesting. If y'all don't mind me plugging on the other podcast that I do, Stuff to Blow Your Mind, Robert Lamb and I did an episode on horizontal gene transfer back in December of 2015, I think. If you want to check that out, there's a whole episode on that.
Awesome. Yeah. One of the other questions that has been kind of roiling around in the scientific community is how cells protect their DNA.
Mm.
With extreme prejudice.
It's yes. I mean, and that is the answer, really. So the inner cell mechanics involving DNA are complex because DNA is stored in a cell's nucleus. Mm-hmm. The nucleus is surrounded by this complex structure called the nuclear envelope, which contains a series of gates that lead in and out of it, which is called the nuclear pore complex. And, you know, molecules have to get in and out of the nucleus so that the cell could, like, create proteins and do stuff. But the envelope also has to be vigilant because if a virus can penetrate it, then it'll hijack the cell's DNA to do its bidding. Bad times. And there are even some diseases that specifically weaken the envelope and make your cell nuclei more susceptible to viral infection. But it's difficult to study because in terms of cell proportion, the envelope is huge. And the pore complex is constantly shifting. The research that I read referred to it as jiggling, like gelatin, like a big old bowl full of jelly. So it's been really hard to get a handle on. Mm-hmm. And this team out of Caltech has been working on it for like a decade, and finally, in this year, in 2016, started to publish results that explain exactly how molecules get transferred transported, rather, like lead into and out of the pores, and how data is moved from DNA to RNA to ribosomes, which, as we said earlier, do that actual work of synthesizing proteins within cells. Mm-hmm. So learning about all of this is just really cool and could help us suss out how to protect ourselves against viral infections.
Well, that's obviously a good thing because of how dependent we are on our DNA. Isn't it kind of annoying that we've got to kowtow to this tiny little molecule? Why can't we be the boss? Why can't we make DNA do what we want it to do?
Well, we're getting there. It's complicated, but we're getting there. What's really cool is that we've actually seen some scientists work with DNA as if it were a programming language, right? Like, it is essentially a set of instructions. So if you were able to write a specific set of instructions, you could, in theory, make some sort of cell do something that you want it to do. So some synthetic biologists have been working with DNA to find ways to manipulate it and program it in this way. So some at MIT developed a software called Cello, C-E-L-L-O, that's essentially, because of the way I'm talking right now, it sounds like I'm saying Jello.
No, it makes me wonder, why didn't they just go ahead and stick an H in there?
Yeah.
It would have been funny.
Cello. Essentially a programming language for DNA. I'm sure it stands for something, and it just didn't see what it stood for.
Right. Wait a minute. A programming language for DNA. Now, that's interesting because oftentimes people use the analogy of a programming language to describe DNA.
Right. So this approach, what it does is it allows people who are not advanced synthetic biologists to come up with ways of programming a strand of DNA to execute a specific type of instruction under a specific circumstance. So in classic computing terms, you can think of it as an if-then. If cell encounters X, then do action Y.
Wow.
Like that sort of thing. You can actually program it to do that sort of stuff.
That's fascinating.
It's pretty cool. So one of the examples that I read about in Nature, where this article was published, said, imagine that you create a strand of DNA that tells the cell to produce a certain drug whenever the cell detects a particular set of metabolic conditions. So in other words, if those metabolic conditions are present, the cell goes into production mode and starts producing this drug. you could easily see how something like that could be incredible for different medicinal purposes.
Yeah, hypothetically. I mean, I'm not sure if this is something that would be possibly on the table, but if your body starts producing histamines in response to some kind of allergen that it's just freaking out about, then your cells could detect those histamines and create antihistamines to calm everything down.
I would like that because I miss shrimp.
Oh.
Yeah, it's all right. That's all right. I've got other things I can eat. I don't really mind.
Well, maybe that's coming in the future.
I sure hope so, because a friend of mine shared a picture of shrimp and grits on Facebook, and now that's all I can think about. So,
all that terrible human.
You listeners out there should know that Jonathan and I were sitting in the studio before recording, and he was just mourning the fact that he couldn't eat this shrimp.
Oh, no.
It was pretty rough. But it's all right. There are bigger problems in the world than my allergy to shellfish. One of those problems, actually, is how do we produce synthetic DNA in a way that is cost effective and is relatively simple, because as it turns out, making DNA in the lab is expensive. It's complicated. It takes a lot of energy.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that part. So we're talking about having a programming language for DNA. But what good is that if you can write a program, but you can't turn it into physical molecules?
Right. It's tough, right? So one of the things that we read about that I thought was so interesting was, some scientists were looking at the possibility of using different chemicals while working with DNA and seeing how that would affect the process. And one person in this group of researchers said, we should really try cyanuric acid. And
I knew him, Horatio.
A fellow of infinite jest. He used to clean my pool. The reason I say that is cyanuric acid is actually used by people to as a treatment for pools. It actually,
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a stabilizer. So, you know, you've heard about adding chlorine to pools so that you can make sure your pool's not infested.
Heard about it. I felt it in my eyeballs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, cyanuric acid, what it does is it binds with chlorine and allows for a more controlled release of chlorine so that you don't just end up like deep shocking your pool and then, you know, 30 minutes later, it just becomes a bacteria cesspit. You don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But cyanuric acid also has an effect on DNA. It actually can cause DNA to form into triple helix formations. The cyanuric acid ends up becoming essentially a third rail of that ladder.
Huh.
And it then ends up having the other two sides bind with it. And this allows for the potential new use of DNA in various nanotechnology applications. Though at the moment, it's really early. Right now, we know that this is the effect it can have on DNA. Where we can actually apply that knowledge remains to be seen. There are a lot of hopes that we can use this in multiple ways, but we're still kind of in the earliest days right now. So it's not like I have a practical application I can just spring out there. So that's sort of our kind of DNA 101, which has lots of open questions in it that are currently being studied by people who are dedicating their lives to that kind of research. In our next episode, we're really going to look at how are we using DNA in practical applications today, and how do we hope to use it in the future? Some of the ways,
apart from just using it to make our bodies.
Right, right.
Well, right. We'll still be doing that.
I mean,
fingers crossed.
I'm not talking about like using it unconsciously. I mean, like consciously making use of
using
DNA.
Using DNA as a technology.
Right. Yeah. Using DNA as a technology. So we're going to really focus on that in our next episode. Guys, remember, if you have any suggestions for future episodes, or you have questions or comments on things we've said, get in touch with us. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. The address you can use if you want to use email is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on social networks. We are on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter, we are FW Thinking. Just search FW Thinking on Facebook. Our profile will pop up. You can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again about DNA really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2.
I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.